had a good substantial breakfast, but that you are hungry to hear the Lord's words today. And I'm excited to be here, trying something new with this different kind of podium. I'm used to having something in front of me. This is a little bit different. So just bear with me. Glad that everybody's here. I really enjoyed that a cappella part where we all just kind of sang and just singing holy, you know, just understanding how holy God is and really enjoying it. You know, we were talking about God's name in that song, and then we talked about Jesus. We said that Jesus is the name. And, you know, it's important for us to understand that, you know, Jesus is the only name on earth by which we can be saved. And so if you've been around for a couple of years and you have heard me preach before, you know that I'm writing a book called God's Heart. And the essence of that is the idea that God has given us his heart and his word, if we would only just kind of dig in there and see it. And anybody can read the word and get that. But what I really desire is for the people who haven't picked up the Bible before, or maybe have just kind of done cursory reviews. Maybe the most that they've ever done is a Sunday morning, just kind of reading through the Bible. And it's kind of like, yeah, those are good stories and everything, but it doesn't really impact my life. But that's not true. The reality of it is that the Bible does impact our lives in a very real way. It tells us the truth. It tells us that there is a heaven and that there is a hell, and that we have the choice to make to accept Jesus into our lives and for him to radically change our lives for the better, definitely for the better. And just understanding those things and seeking out God's heart in that, understanding that we've all made mistakes, we call that sin, and that we need to be saved from those things, and that Jesus is the only way to do that. And so I've been working through those different things with this book, God's Heart, and so this is coming, definitely big portions of this are coming from that, trying to understand those things. So if you were here the last time that I spoke, I talked about Abraham's two sons, and so just kind of overview here, you know, Genesis talks about the creation and Adam and Eve, the first humans, and we see that history, and we've talked about all those different things. We've talked about Abraham and meeting Melchizedek and King Bera, right? That was a couple sermons ago. And then we talked about Sarai and Abraham, and how they become Abraham and Sarah, and they pray for so long to have a child, and they do it their own way, and they have Ishmael through Hagar, and then 13 years later, Abraham and Sarah have Isaac, and this is the lineage that God is following. This is the promises of God. This is the prophecy. This is what God wants through those different things. And so the last sermon that I gave, I did some comparisons on Abraham's two sons, on Ishmael and Isaac. And I told you the real-life guys, Hisham and Joel. I don't know if you remember that. The Arabic guy, right? And the Israeli guy. And we made those comparisons, and we talked about all of that. And then we wrapped it all up in the prodigal son story from Luke 15, and how Jesus kind of ties those things together, and you know, the blessings and all of that kind of stuff. So Isaac is an interesting guy. It's interesting, though, that not much of Genesis is actually given to Isaac and his life. He kind of doesn't do a whole lot. In fact, if you're reading through, because I'm kind of going to be skipping a couple chapters, Genesis 23 and 24 are talking about Isaac a little bit, but Abraham's godly servant who's sent out to find Isaac a wife, he's given almost as much time as Isaac is. And I kind of wish that we could spend time on that servant and the different things that he does in God's will and what a godly man he is. But, you know, we need to kind of keep moving. And ultimately, we're going to talk about Jacob, Isaac's son. Not that Isaac isn't important. He's part of that chain, that the patriarchs. We know them as Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? And so Isaac is important, but we don't get a whole lot from him, and it's certainly not a lot of good stuff. So we're going to kind of focus on his son Jacob, and that's what we're going to be looking at. We're going to be in Genesis 25 a little bit, mostly 27 and 28, talking through those different things. And so today we're going to be talking about kind of how bad Jacob was. And the reason that I want to focus a little bit on that, it's common for us to kind of say, well, you know, God doesn't dwell on the bad things in us, so we'll kind of skip over those things and we'll move on to the kind of fluffy stuff or the nice stuff, the stuff that makes us feel good. But we can't understand where Jacob got to if we don't understand where he was. And so Jacob, I like to call it Jacob's trilogy of transformation. He has three different things that happen in his life that God puts out there, and it changes him. It transforms him. We're not going to have enough time to talk about all three today, but we're going to talk about kind of who he was and how rotten a guy he was, and then we're going to talk about that part one. We're going to talk about that first step in Jacob's transformation. And, you know, it's important because Jacob is a deceiver. And it's important for us to understand that. Now, there's a film, a documentary film called The Imposter. How many of you have heard of or seen it? Okay. So, my wife, one person. The Imposter is very, very interesting documentary. And it's this story about this kid, and I'll try not to spoil it for you in case you want to watch it. It's about this kid who disappears in Texas. And 3 years after his disappearance, there is this guy in Spain, and he says, I am that kid. And despite not really looking like that guy and having a fairly thick Spanish accent, he gets granted like full access, comes into the United States, and comes home to the family, right? And I'm not going to ruin much for you. However, I'll just let you know the tagline because you could have heard that on your own, so it shouldn't really ruin anything for you. But the tagline is "Deception comes home," and you know, it's a good movie because what I've told you isn't the half of it. Kind of what happens on the second half of the movie and everything, I'm not going to ruin it. But my point in all of this is that there is deception alive and well from the beginning, right? Where Adam Satan deceived Eve, and then Adam tries to deceive God and all of these different things all the way on through. So we're really going to see this with Jacob, but I want you to know that it's alive and well with us today, deception, those kinds of things, the understanding of that. You know, my company has us do these video tutorial things to kind of stay up to speed on business ethics and all this different stuff. And deception is one of the things that they focus in on. They don't want us to be deceiving the company. They don't want us to deceive our customers or our vendors or whatever. Deception is an important thing. And so the imposter really showed that to me. Man, this is alive and well today, deception. All of us are capable of this. And a little caveat to that, the imposter is rated R for language. So make the right choice for you on whether you're going to see that or not. But really, really interesting to me to think about how deception is here amongst all of us, and certainly we're all capable of it. So let's go ahead and pray, and we'll dig in. Lord, thank you so much for this time. I pray that you would just impact the hearts and the minds of both the people sitting here and the people that are listening on sermon audio. And God, I just pray for these words to really drive home to my friends and family here, and all around the world. Of course, as much as they've impacted me, this is such a good thing for all of us to hear. So I'm excited to dig in, get into the meat of the word. We're not interested in kind of the milk and just barely getting by. We want to really dig in and see your heart in all of these things. So we thank you for your word and this time. In Jesus' name, amen. So, at the end of Genesis 24, Isaac and Rebekah get married. And Genesis 25 starts off telling us that they get pregnant with twins, Esau and Jacob, these two brothers. Now, the boys fight in the womb, and Rebekah says, there's something wrong. What's going on? You know, it's very possible she was thinking, am I going to have a miscarriage? What's going on in my womb? This doesn't feel right. There's something wrong. And so she seeks God. And she asks God, what is going on? And God speaks to her. He gives her a prophecy. He says exactly what is happening there. And he says, and I love it because the word that's used here is Yahweh in the Hebrew, which means covenant keeper. Remember that. We've talked about that in the past. When it says Yahweh, it's talking about how God is a covenant keeper. Remember, he's given covenants to Abraham. He said, you know, you're going to spread out. You're going to have this family that's going to thrive more than the sand of the seashore. You won't be able to count them. And all of those kinds of things. You'll dwell in this land, Canaan, and all of that kind of stuff. Those are the promises that God's keeping. And so he's telling the parents, this is the chosen line. I'm keeping these things. I am a God of my word, right? And the Abrahamic covenant and all of that, it's going to pass through the younger son, Jacob, okay? Interestingly, the name Jacob literally means supplanter, meaning overthrow. A supplanter is someone who overthrows. It also means heel grabber, okay? Figuratively meaning deceiver or conniver, what we would call a con man these days. Manipulator. I've given you a lot of words of what Jacob means. Just be thinking con man, think deceiver, okay, when you have the name Jacob, which is true from the very, very beginning. And if you know the story, Esau starts to come out, and as he comes out, Jacob, I mean, we're talking about the birth, right? Jacob's little hand shoots out and grabs onto Esau's foot and is holding him back, trying to pull him back. I want to be first. That's why they named him Jacob. Heel grabber. He grabs on. And like I said, figuratively, that deception, the desire to place himself where he should not be, in a position where he should not be. And so that's what we find out. And God speaks in Genesis 25:23. If you want to read along, this is what he gives to Rebekah. And Rebekah surely shared this with Isaac and others. God said, two nations are in your womb. Two peoples shall be separated from your body. One people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. So it's God's heart to make Jacob one of the patriarchs of his promises through Abraham. Promises to Abraham, it's descending down to Jacob specifically. God could see what Jacob would become, and he still said, that's my man. That's the one that I want right there. As we'll see, Jacob isn't the one that we would have picked. If we had been in God's position and we had seen Jacob as he was growing up into that young adulthood and all of that kind of stuff, the more and more that we would have looked at him, we would have said, nope, that's not the right one to carry on the Abrahamic covenant, all of these things that God is going to ultimately fulfill through. But then, and we'll talk more about this later in the next sermon when I talk about points 2 and 3 of the Trilogy of Transformation, we'll see about Esau and how we would have thought that would have been the first choice, but ultimately God sees, and it's God's heart to see Jacob's heart. Maybe not where he was at that point in time, but where he was going to be. And that's really reassuring for me, and I hope that that's reassuring for you. That you may think, man, I'm really an awful lady. I'm really an awful guy, right? And it's great because God says, okay, I'll agree with you on that right now. Transformation. I'm going to transform you. I don't see who you are right now. I see who I will make you become. It's awesome because God sees who Jacob will become. So Jacob has his issues, just like his father and his grandfather, as we're about to see, but God is patiently making them into men after his own heart, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so the boys grow older, and Esau is a man's man. He's a hunter. But it talks about Jacob dwelling in tents. It's kind of the difference between me and Pastor Troy. Pastor Troy is a man's man. He goes out there. He works in construction. He has the calluses on his hands that I wish that I had. He has all of these different things. He goes out there. Essentially, he would be that kind of hunter, that alpha male figure. As for me, I work in an office. I use my mind in the day-to-day. Not that Troy doesn't use his mind. I'm not saying that. I'm not implying anything like that. I would love to be able to do all the things that Troy can do. But think of it like that. Think of it as the modern-day hunter, construction worker, that man's man. And then Jacob is the office worker. He's the person typing away. It talks about him preparing meals. He's kind of inside and doing those kinds of things. And so we get a feel for who the two brothers are. What are their perspectives on life? What is the type of relationships that they have? These are the things that we can kind of glean from that. Their personalities, right? So we understand who they are. And there's very clearly favoritism between the parents and the kids. Okay? So Isaac loves Esau, and Rebekah loves Jacob. Mom loves the boy that's in the tent, and the dad likes the guy that goes out and hunts and brings in the food and all of that. Isaac kind of thinks with his belly, as many of us are very capable of doing. And so there's favoritism there, which is never a good thing. It'll never work out well. It's never a good situation to raise a family in. So let's dig into Genesis 25, and we're going to read verses 29 through 34. This is the first point where we really dig into the details of who Jacob was and kind of that con man mentality. Genesis 25, verses 29 through 34. Now Jacob cooked a stew, and Esau came in from the field. And he was weary, and Esau said to Jacob, "Please feed me with that same red stew, for I am weary." Therefore his name was called Edom. But Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright as of this day." And Esau said, "Look, I'm about to die, so what is this birthright to me?" Then Jacob said, "Swear to me as of this day." So he swore to him, sold his birthright to Jacob, and Jacob gave Esau bread and stew of lentils. Then he ate and drank, arose, and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Okay? Now, it doesn't seem like Jacob was making this stew intentionally to trap Esau. However, you can tell that his mind's been going. Okay? His mind has been going, and he wants that birthright. Right? And he's going to take the opportunity, and however it presents itself, to take that birthright from Esau. And so the opportunity arises. And Esau says, yeah, just give me stew. What point is there if I die right here? Which he may have been being a little dramatic. And he says, what point is it in having a birthright if I keel over and die right here? Right? And notice that Jacob, ever the negotiator, ever the one to make sure that the contract is signed and all of that, he says, yeah, but swear to me as of this day in verse 33. Swear to me about this. I need your signature on this, right? And so he makes sure that all the details are in order, all favoring him in that way. But what does a birthright matter? Maybe for us nowadays, we don't really understand what birthright means. Well, obviously, in the birth, it would be the firstborn and the rights of that firstborn, birthright. And so in Deuteronomy 21:17 and 1 Chronicles 5:1-2, you can jot those down. You don't have to turn there. It shows that it's both a physical and spiritual dynamic. Okay, the birthright has both of those things. By Esau handing it over to Jacob, this would mean that at the passing of the father, Isaac, then Jacob would become the head of the family, physically, as patriarch, head of the family, but he would also be the spiritual leader of that family, okay? what kind of spiritual leader of the family are you when you've stolen the very thing that gives you the spiritual leadership, right? You're not going to direct the family spiritually in the right ways if you've stolen the very thing, if you've deceived and lied and gotten it gaining this thing illegitimately, right? And so he's not going to be a very good spiritual leader of the household in this way. Nevertheless, it's very interesting to me that God allows it. Now, I don't want to gloss over Genesis 26 because, although, kind of as I mentioned, Isaac shows weakness, he also shows some strength. Just as Abraham had been scared about being killed by Sarah's beauty, Isaac kind of does the same thing. And maybe I should explain that a little bit more. A couple places in Genesis, it talks about how Abraham is going into, you know, Egypt or wherever, and he has his wife Sarah. She's very beautiful, and he says, they're going to kill me to get to her. And so he lies, right? And he says, she's my sister, so that he doesn't get killed. Not a very good husbandly thing to do. If you're supposed to be the priest of your household, if you're supposed to lead by example, you're not doing a very good thing by saying, hey, wife, you may get, you know, raped or stolen, married off to the Pharaoh or whoever it might be. I just want to save my own skin. Not necessarily a good thing. Abraham does this twice, and in Genesis 26, what do we see? Like father, like son. Isaac does the exact same thing about Rebekah. Maybe they shouldn't have married ladies that were that beautiful if they had that inferiority complex and the whole thing. And so it's very interesting to me because, like father, like son, right? Isaac has seen dad do this, so Isaac does it. Well, where does that get passed down to? Of course, Esau and Jacob see these things and go, oh, that's how to live life. I'm supposed to deceive. I'm supposed to lie. I'm supposed to be afraid. I'm not supposed to trust in God. Genesis 26, that kind of sums that up for us. Now, we see that deception getting passed on to the kids. Manipulation is okay, and you should practice that. Let's move into Genesis 27. There are going to be certain portions that we're going to look at here. Now we're going to see another part of Jacob's deception, what kind of guy he was, much like us in doing the bad stuff, not doing the right thing. Genesis 27, we're going to read verses 1 through 4. It says, now it came to pass when Isaac was old and his eyes were so dim that he could not see, that he called Esau, his older son, and said to him, my son. And he answered him, here I am. Then he said, behold, now I am old. I do not know the day of my death. Now, therefore, please take your weapons, your quiver and your bow, go into the field and hunt game for me, and make me savory food, such as I love, and bring it to me that I may eat, that my soul may bless you before I die. Isaac feels that he's dying, even though he's got 60 more years of life, according to Genesis 35:28. He's still got 60 years, but he thinks he may die. He's blind, and he asks Esau to go out there. Notice how he's trying to reverse the birthright blessing, okay? So this is father, Isaac, and he's trying to reverse the blessing that Jacob stole from Esau, okay? He said, even though he knows God gave a prophecy about Jacob usurping Esau, that Esau would serve Jacob, he knows this, but he's still trying to do it. In fact, in this blessing, Isaac never seeks God. Not only that, he never even mentions God in this, in his strategy of what he's going to do with Esau. Notice that. I didn't have the time to count it, but you sure can. Notice how many times, just in these four verses, Isaac says, I, me, my. It's all very self-centered. This is all about him and what he wants. I'm going to bless you so that my soul will be blessed. Go make me some savory food because I'm hungry. This is all about Isaac and wanting his favorite son to take over that family. He needs his own hunger needs to be met and all of that kind of stuff. So Isaac tries to sneak Esau in through favoritism. Let's read verses 5 through 12. Now Rebekah was listening when Isaac spoke to Esau, his son, and Esau went to the field to hunt game and to bring it. So Rebekah spoke to Jacob, her son, saying, "Indeed, I heard your father speak to Esau, your brother, saying, 'Bring me game and make savory food for me, that I may eat it and bless you in the presence of the Lord before my death.'" Notice that Rebekah says, "in the presence of the Lord." We never hear that. I don't believe that that was said. She had kind of the right thought that you bless in the name of God because God is asking for this thing. We never heard Isaac say that. Verse 8, "Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to what I command you. Go now to the flock, bring me from there two choice kids of goats, and I will make savory food from them for your father, such as he loves. Then you shall take it to your father, that he may eat, and that he may bless you before his death." And Jacob said to Rebekah his mother, "Look, Esau my brother is a hairy man, I am a smooth-skinned man. Perhaps my father will feel me, get this, and I shall seem to be a deceiver to him." I will seem to be a deceiver? No, you are. "And I shall bring a curse on myself and not a blessing." Very, very interesting. So, in case you didn't catch all of that, Rebekah's listening probably through a kind of a tent wall, and she hears everything that transpires with Isaac and Esau. She goes over to Jacob, her favorite, and she goes, "This is what you're going to do. Go out, get a goat, I'll cook it. We'll pretend like you're Esau, and then Isaac, because he's blind, will give you the blessing." And Isaac goes, "Well, Mom," he's always thinking too, very, very deceptive, just like everybody in his family. And he goes, "But I'm not a hairy guy, but Esau is. What if Dad recognizes the deception, and what should we do?" Right? And so they recognize that, and they take skins and they put them on Jacob. Now, I find it so amazing because, like I said, I emphasize that seem like a deceiver. Jacob says, "Oh, what if I seem like a deceiver to my father?" He's still not getting it. He's not acknowledging his name, Jacob. It means deceiver. This is you, man. This is what you've always done. And furthermore, he recognizes that he would be bringing a curse on himself if he did this thing and he was found out instead of a blessing. Very interesting. So he sort of knows that right and wrong in the same breath as he doesn't recognize or at least won't acknowledge that he is a deceiver. So then my question is going to get a little bit personal here for you. Are you deceiving someone? I think now is a good time for us to consider these things. Are you deceiving someone? And it's very easy for us to sit here and say, "No, I'm a pretty good Christian person. I know these things." Or even if you're not a Christian, you say, "No, that's not really my MO. I don't really deceive people. I know that I'm not the best of the best, but that's not really me." But think about it. Truly think about it. I mean, why else are we here? Why are we digging into the Word if it's not going to change us? Don't just sit here with a hard heart and just think, "No, that's not me. I just kind of want to get out of here doing my checkbox for the Sunday morning thing." Think about these things. Have you deceived a family member? Have you deceived a friend? I know that I'm guilty of it. Think about those kinds of things. What about the government? Have you deceived the government? Maybe that would be in taxes or whatever it might be. I knew somebody who rode around with a dummy in their front seat so that they could go in the carpool lane. Okay? That's deception. That's acting like you've got someone else in the car. And I always just thought, man, that's so weird. Like, why? Because you're just cruising around even when you're not in the carpool lane and you've got this dummy in the front seat with you. That's just awkward and weird. So maybe you don't do that. Maybe you don't do deception at that level. But my mind thinks about movies and TV, downloads, music, all of those kinds of things. In our day and age, it's very easy for us to get a hold of those things illegally, right? And I want you to think about that. Are you doing that? My question would be, what is the price of your integrity? Because people are paying attention to those things when you do that kind of stuff. And I will say that I'm able to keep up with everybody who's watching TV shows and movies and all of that, and I don't have to do it illegally, and I don't spend a fortune doing it. Get the network app on your phone. They put the shows on there. you know, get Hulu or Netflix or whatever for a month if you really want to watch a show. It's like $7. Why am I kind of diving into those specific things? I think that's reality. That's 2017 in the day in which we live. And maybe I haven't hit upon something specific to you, but I certainly know and have friends and different people who do those kinds of things. And that is deception. And you may say, oh, these networks, they make billions of dollars. What's this? That's not the point. It's illegal. It's wrong. It's not something that God is exactly happy with you about if you are doing those things. And more importantly, for a cost of a couple bucks, you can have your integrity intact and you can be a good witness to the Lord. So don't allow this little passing deception or something like that affect you. It's very, very interesting to me about these deceptions and these different things. And I think about a friend of mine who had an aunt pass away. And when she passed away, the family was cleaning out her house, and there was kind of this back area. It had been an enclosed, outer area that became kind of this back room, and nobody had really gone back there very much. When she passed away, they're cleaning out the house, and they go back there. Hundreds of Amazon boxes. Okay, she had stolen her neighbor's Amazon boxes. They had ordered things, and she would go up and take it, never opening them, very like klepto of her to not actually open them. But this was a thing for her to grab onto those things and hold on to them. Now, she kept it in this locked room so that nobody would really know about that. She was deceiving her family about those things. And I think about that because this is what we're getting at, both the deception, but also the inheritance. What is it that we get from our families, right? Do we get a bunch of Amazon Prime boxes shoved in a back room? Is that the legacy that we're looking to leave? Now, this guy is not a Christian, but he and his family did the right thing, the hard thing, and they went back to each one of those addresses, each one of those people, and they said, really sorry about this. My family member stole this from you like 2 years ago or whatever it was. I'm sure you've been compensated for it or whatever, but this is the right thing to do. I'm giving these back to you. And I want us to consider those things because every single one of us will go through an inheritance thing. And man, all of the times that I've seen that happen, or a good majority of them, there are little wars that break out between family members over these things. And sometimes it's a house, which is kind of a big deal. Maybe it's a car or something. And sometimes it's over like the china or a knickknack that somebody really, really wants. And then they stop speaking to this other family member because they really, really want that thing. And if you haven't been through that yet, that's great, but you will go through it. As people pass away, it's amazing how that family fights and bickers and all of this different stuff goes to war with each other over the inheritance of these family members. So I'd caution you in those things. It's no different as it was back then with Jacob and Isaac and all of this different stuff, that deception, that hunger over the inheritance. That's what Jacob wants. He wants the inheritance. He wants all of that. Not the spiritual inheritance, which he should be trying to get from God. He wants the property. He wants the money. He wants all of that kind of stuff. So be good to your family members. Lead by example. When these things come up, when the inheritance things comes through, like, pray about these things. Be the peacemaker in the situation. Maybe set up some different things prior to these things happening. Have some of those hard conversations and that kind of stuff. It's very important for us to have the right legacy and to think about inheritance in the right way. These are some of the things that we can gain from this story. Now, we're not going to read verses 13 through 17 here, but I'll just kind of give you a brief overview. Rebekah convinces Jacob to participate in the counterplot, and she puts animal skins on him, she cooks the meat, and they move forward. It's very much like kind of one of those, I don't know, espionage kind of movies with spies and all this different stuff. They're sneaking in here and doing this and counterplotting this other stuff. So let's go ahead and read in verses 18 through 24. This is Jacob going in to receive that blessing from his father, Isaac. He's all set up. He has the skins on. He has the meal. So he, Jacob, went to his father and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am. Who are you, my son?" Okay? So Isaac recognizes, man, that voice doesn't quite sound like who I was expecting. Jacob said to his father, I am Esau, your firstborn. Straight up lie. I have done just as you told me. Please arise, sit, and eat of my game, that your soul may bless me. But Isaac said to his son, how is it that you have found it so quickly, my son? How did you go out, find it, hunt it, kill it, bring it in, cook it so quickly? And he said, because the Lord your God, not my God, your God, brought it to me. Isaac said to Jacob, please come near that I may feel you, my son, whether you are really my son Esau or not. Okay, there's still this idea in his mind. This isn't quite right. Verse 22, so Jacob went near to Isaac his father, and he felt him and said, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And he did not recognize him because his hands were hairy like his brother Esau's hands, so he blessed him. Then he said, are you really my son Esau? Just one more time. What does Jacob say? I am. Jacob has multiple chances to come clean, but he doesn't. In fact, he unapologetically lies several different times that he's definitely Esau. So, there was this lady, this may have been about 10 years ago or so, at my work. And she came into the purchasing department. I now work in the purchasing department. I wasn't there at this time. And when she came in to my work, she misrepresented herself on her resume, on her application, and in her day-to-day duties. Resume, application, day-to-day duties. She lied through her teeth. Her experience was stellar. They couldn't help but hire her. Wow, you're willing to, you've got this much experience, and you're willing to work for this amount and everything. And as she came in, it took about a month or so, but they recognized, this lady doesn't know what she's doing. Not only that, but she was physically threatening other people in her department. That's what happens when we deceive. We get nervous. We don't like it. And when we get questioned on things, we start to get angry. And we start to lash out and threaten people. Right? And that may have been one of the things that started to make that question get asked when it was reported to HR. And you start to, all of that stuff starts to unravel when you deceive. Again, alive and well in our day-to-day, everyday aspects of life. When you falsify these different things and you pretend to be someone else that you are, I mean, it took a month for them to recognize it. But what happened? She was immediately terminated. You can only do that at so many companies before you get found out. And then what are you going to do? Right? So that deceit, the idea of these kinds of things, this is exactly what Jacob was doing, lying through his teeth. But he's going to be found out, not by his father. His father blesses him, but by God. God knows these things that Jacob is doing. It's interesting to me because God allows this. God allows Jacob to steal the blessing. Why would a good God allow something like that to happen? In his prophecy, he knew it was going to happen. We read it before the boys were even born. God knows all of these different things. He doesn't cause Jacob's deceit. Remember, the Bible tells us that God does not lie. He never causes us to lie or to sin or any of those things. He doesn't even tempt us, but he allows those things because we have the free will to choose, right? We have the free will. It's not about God forcing Jacob to do the right thing. No, you don't learn from that. You don't get transformed when you're a robot and you get forced into something. But God knows. God knew. God sees all the way to the end. We have it all the way through Revelation. We know what's going to happen. God knows this better than anyone else, of course. He sees the deceit. But because it's in his plan, he allows it. He wants Jacob to become the patriarch. He wants to change him. Okay? So he allows it. God allows this thing to happen, and God allows those things to happen in our own lives. Maybe something bad happens to us. Maybe we get away with a lie or deception or something like that, and we kind of look back and go, wow, God, why did you allow me to do that? Or, whew, I really made it through, right? And God knows. God knows that you've done it. He sees that you've done it. He allows it because he's going to be changing you. He's going to be transforming you. It's all part of his plan. Now, in verses 25 through 34, Isaac gives Jacob that blessing that he hungered after, just as much as Isaac hungered after that food. Jacob hungered after it, and he got that blessing. And as he leaves, Esau comes in, and then they realize the deception. On your own, go ahead and read verses 25 through 34 after this. It's pretty great. It's like a heist movie. So Isaac gives Jacob the blessing and everything, and as Jacob leaves the tent and that door swings shut, that fabric door swings shut, and Jacob makes it around the corner, Esau is reaching that very door that may still be just kind of swinging shut right there. And he comes in, he goes, "Okay, Dad, I've got the meal, let's do this." And Isaac goes, "Who are you?" And they immediately recognize what has happened. The deception. Again, Jacob has deceived. Yet again, he has done this thing. So, let's read verses 35 through 36. This is the recognition. "But he," Isaac, "said, 'Your brother came with deceit and has taken away your blessing.'" What does Esau do? What does Esau say? "Is he not rightly named Jacob?" This should stand out to us. What does Jacob mean? Deceiver. "Is he not rightly named deceiver? For he has supplanted me these two times. He took away my birthright. Now, look, he's taken away my blessing. And he said, 'Have you not reserved a blessing for me? Dad, don't you have anything for me?' But what's done is done. That blessing has gone out." Now, some commentators think that the birthright and the blessing were the same thing, but it's fairly evident that it keeps being described as two different things, right? Jacob knew that and really, really wanted that. And Esau's just going, "Come on, Dad, please, just give me something." And yet they know that cannot be. Esau cannot have the blessing that was just given to Jacob. That's done. That is now Jacob's. Now, Isaac does give Esau a prophecy, but it's almost an anti-blessing. If you read through it, he speaks mostly about how well Jacob will do, right? Isaac does mention that eventually Esau will finally kind of break free of the rule of Jacob in the senses of the nations, Edom and Israel. They'll kind of break away from that in the future. That's history kind of a thing. So Esau swears to kill Jacob. Yet again, Rebekah, the mom, is listening through the tent flap. She hears this, and she goes, "That's it. Jacob's got to get out of here. Esau is going to kill Jacob right now. Okay, Jacob, come here. Your brother's going to kill you. Get out." So he runs away. He flees. He has deceived. What did he think was going to happen? He runs away. And he's gone for a little while. And then he comes back. And Isaac and Rebekah are tired of Esau's wife, who has caused them nothing but trouble. She's a pagan wife. She's not a godly wife. And they say, "Look, Jacob, you cannot take a wife from around here. You have to go out and find a godly wife." Okay? And so they kind of say, "Be on your way. Be blessed. Go to Uncle Laban. Go to your Uncle Laban and find a wife for yourself." Okay, she needs to be a godly wife. This whole unequally yoked thing isn't working. You need to go. So he basically comes, stops in, gets told what to do, and then he takes off. Okay, Esau doesn't have the chance to kill him. God is kind of protecting Jacob in this way. So now we've moved to that point where Jacob is going out to Laban. Okay, he's going to go to Uncle Laban and try and find a godly wife there. To reiterate, just kind of to push the pause here for a second, now we've seen all the bad stuff that Jacob has done. We can identify with those different things. This is part one. We're starting in on part one of that trilogy of transformation. Okay, this is part one of where Jacob gets the transformation, the beginnings of the transformation from God at this point. And so we pick up our story. Genesis 28:10. I'll let you turn there. Moving through into the next chapter. Jacob is now going to Uncle Laban. Genesis 28:10-11 says, "Now Jacob went out from Beersheba and went towards Haran. So he came to a certain place and stayed there all night, because the sun had set. And he took one of the stones of that place and put it at his head, and he lay down in that place to sleep." Just so you know, Jacob is starting a 400-mile journey. He's going to be going 400 miles, okay? Night one, this happens, okay? This is night one of that journey. He's still not even out of the land of Canaan. He's still in the land, but he's separated himself, okay? He's going out, very, very first night, and it says that he came to a certain place. We don't know that this is Bethel yet because he hasn't named it. But in the verses that we're about to read, we'll hear him name this Bethel. So that's kind of important for us to remember. Bethel, this is that certain place. It's important for us to notice this is the very first night that he is alone. He has separated himself from his family. He's probably not too lonely yet, although he's going to kind of get to that part, but he definitely recognizes that he is alone and that he is going to start to feel lonely on a 400-mile trek, okay, on that journey. And remember, he's just lied and cheated his family, right? That's what he's going out from. So what happens next? Verses 12 through 15 state, "Then he dreamed, and behold, a ladder was set up on the earth, and its top reached to heaven, and there the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord God of Abraham your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie I will give to you and your descendants. Also your descendants shall be as the dust of the earth. You shall spread abroad to the west and to the east, north and south. And in you and in your seed all the families of the earth shall be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have spoken to you." So notice, Jacob has grabbed one of the stones. This is going to be important. He uses it as a pillow, and he has this fantastic dream. This is God's first appearance that we know of, and it seems like it's his first appearance to Jacob. And in this, he shows him a ladder, or more likely a staircase, descending from heaven. It's significant because it shows us and Jacob at this time, we all learn from this. Jacob is learning from it. God's heart is to tell us these things so that we can read and understand. It's important for us to understand there is a heavenly realm. This is real. This is reality. Jacob's eyes are opened to this, and so there is a heavenly realm which has access to earth. Jacob was alone, remember that. But the truth is that God and his helpers are involved in people's affairs. So when you're alone, when you're lonely, know that God is there and he has his messengers. He has those who can do nothing but obey him, his angels. And they're intimately involved in our affairs. We cannot see it. We know that that is the spiritual realm. Just as they were there, ascending and descending, right? We can take comfort in that. God is there. He sees all of these things. He knows who Jacob is. Not just Jacob, but the lineage. He's been there all the way through, right? He reiterates those promises. Now, I don't know if you were here in February. Troy was starting the book of John. But he mentioned some of these things in John 1, 45 through 51. And we're not specifically going to read from there, but you can certainly turn there if you'd like to. I just like to recall you back to some things that we've learned in the past. This is helpful for all of us to truly digest this stuff and apply it to our own lives. I love this because this is Jesus speaking, right? All of the Bible, regardless of where we read, Old Testament, New Testament, it's all pointing towards Jesus. It's always focused on Jesus. It's always Jesus who has done these things, said these things, promised these things, fulfilled these things, right? And so we're going to slightly look at John 1. And this is the calling of Nathanael, the disciple Nathanael. And if you remember, when Troy was going through this, he talked about those things, okay? He talked about this very story with Jacob's ladder, okay? So, initially, Nathanael, I'll go ahead and tell you the story. Initially, Nathanael is condescending towards Nazareth when he hears that Jesus has come from Nazareth. Hey, Nazareth. Hey, Nathanael, you got to see this guy Jesus. Where's he from? He's from Nazareth. Nathanael's condescending towards that place where Jesus was. Oddly, he's not focused on Philip's news of the Messiah. He just discounts it, right? Because of Jesus being from a, and I quote, worthless place. That was very common. That's where Jesus is from now. Don't need to hear anything about him. But as soon as Nathanael approaches Jesus, Jesus says, "Behold, an Israelite indeed in whom is no deceit." Jesus is saying like a book's worth just in that line. Jesus's acknowledgement of Nathanael's stellar bloodline. He's an Israelite. Jesus acknowledges that, and his upbringing is only overshadowed. How could Jesus possibly know that? It's only overshadowed by the amazing words, "in whom is no deceit." Jesus, speaking here, it's recorded for us in the Greek, says dolos. It means deceit in the Greek. When you translate it into Hebrew, it means Jacob. In whom is no Jacob, okay? So, Jesus sees Nathanael and he says, "In whom is no Jacob? In whom is no deceit?" Now, the word for deceit that I already mentioned to you, that dolos, in verse 48, Nathanael responds, "How do you know me?" This hits him right in the heart, as Jesus always does. It hits Nathanael right in the heart. "How do you know me?" Acknowledging both that Jesus had identified some things specific to Nathanael, and also potentially what he had just been reading, as we're about to find out. What do I mean by that? Jesus retorts to him, "Before Philip called you, before Philip walked up to you a couple minutes ago, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." How could Jesus have possibly seen him? Jesus is over here. Philip is walking up to Nathanael over there. Then, you know, 5 minutes later, Philip is leading Nathanael over to Jesus. How could Jesus have known these things? How could he have seen these things? The focus shouldn't be on the fig tree. Often we focus in on what was Nathanael doing? What does the fig tree mean and all of that? It doesn't really matter what it represents. Rather, what Nathanael was doing under that tree. Nathanael could very well have been reading the scriptures, and God showed him something from that, okay? If that was the case, then Jesus could have been claiming to be the one who showed Nathanael that epiphany. It's conjecture to a degree, but it's possible he was specifically reading Genesis 27 about Jacob's deceit and Genesis 28 about Jacob's ladder, okay? This is possible because Nathanael's response to Jesus is a statement of shock and immediate worship. What does Nathanael say? "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." This is prior to Jesus even starting his ministry. Nathanael calls him Rabbi, which means teacher. He hasn't even started teaching yet. And yet Nathanael recognizes this thing. The thing that makes the most sense there is that Nathanael had this epiphany while reading what we consider to be Genesis 27 and 28. Deceit and Jacob's ladder. Deceit and the transformation, the beginnings of transformation of Jacob. And now Jesus is speaking to Nathanael in that same way. You're hungry. You're searching for God. You don't have deceit in you. You're not trying to get around that. You're truly looking for the Messiah. You want to know who the Messiah is? I am He, is essentially what Jesus is saying. And I love it because Nathanael's response is the response that all of us have had. It is the one true and only response that anyone can have. Rabbi, teacher, right? What does he say? He says, "Teacher, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." He doesn't have a crown. He doesn't have any of those different things. How could Nathanael know these things about Jesus? And I love it. I want to point you towards that Son of God. By Nathanael's own lips, he is saying Son of God. When we hear Son of God, we always know that points to Jesus' deity. We know that this is saying you are one with the Father. You are truly the Son of God. Okay, we're going to see Jesus say, "I am the Son of Man" in a couple of verses. But he says, "You are the Son of God." Jesus does not decline that. Of course he is. How else could he have known these things? Only God can know who Nathanael was, where he was, what he was reading, all of that different stuff. Of course Jesus saw it. Jesus being fully God, right? And so he correctly cries out in that way. It's a reassuring scene when we go back to Jacob, and Jacob says, "Wow, Yahweh, covenant keeper, is speaking to me." God calls himself Yahweh here in this for us, probably written down by Moses in Genesis here, God's heart to show us that he is the covenant keeper. And then what does he do? He lists that covenant. In short, he gives us a synopsis of what it is. He says, "Look, I know you. I know you, Jacob. I knew Abraham, gave him the promise. Talk to Isaac, your father, gave him the promise. Your turn. This is you now. Through your seed, the descendants will come." Again, Yahweh is used, covenant keeper, acknowledging those promises of the patriarchs is going to be kept through Jacob. Interesting that God doesn't chew out Jacob from where he just came from, deceiving the family, stealing the blessings, all this different stuff. In this moment, that's not God's heart. He doesn't need to chew Jacob out on this for stealing those blessings. Instead, he simply states to Jacob, "You will be a blessing to others." I find that so fascinating. In the prophecies, in the blessings that God gives to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, time and again he reiterates why he is going to keep that through Israel, through these prophecies. He says, "It's so that I can bless others." Who are the others? Gentiles, all the nations of the world. God reiterates this. He doesn't just want to bless one group, one family. He's going to use them as his chosen and promised people to point to himself at all times. But that goes out, right? Through Jesus, through the gospel, through the good news. God is giving these different things. He just said it for us here in Genesis, that it is so that you are a blessing to all the people. But it's so funny to me because Jacob doesn't seem to acknowledge that. Pridefully, his mind is just centered on me. I just got to talk to God, right? God just spoke to me about these different things. And it's kind of this prideful thing where he doesn't even acknowledge it. He doesn't seem to fully understand the importance of this pointed promise of pride breaking. He's going to have his pride broken. This isn't all about you. I want to bless all the nations of the earth. I want all people to know that I am God and that they can come to me. I will be everything to them. I will be their shelter and they can go to heaven through me. Let's continue. Genesis 28:16-19. "Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, 'Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it.'" And I did not know it. "And he was afraid and said, 'How awesome is this place?'" He's really focused on the place. "This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven. Then Jacob rose early in the morning, took the stone that he had put at his head, set it up as a pillar, poured oil on top of it, and he called the name of that place Bethel. But the name of that city had been Luz previously." Jacob's correct response was awe and worship. That is the proper response when God has made himself known to you, when God has spoken to you, when God has reached out. God has spoken to each of you through maybe another Christian. Maybe it's through the Bible. Maybe that still small voice that impacts your conscience, right? God has spoken, and the only response is awe and worship, just as Jacob had. Remember our story from John 1 that we were just talking about, Nathanael and Jesus and all of that? It's important to note that Jesus tells Nathanael that he will see even greater things than a ladder of angels. Okay, Nathanael, you're going to live through and see even greater things than that miraculous thing that you just read about that Jacob got to do. Jesus says, "You shall see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." Now, does Jesus say you're going to see heaven open, angels and descending upon a staircase, a ladder? No, he says that he is that staircase. He says, you're going to see angels ascending and descending to heaven on me, and he calls himself the Son of Man, his claim to be fully man. Nathanael called him fully God, rightfully so. He is also fully man. It's interesting to me that the angels ascend and descend on Jesus. In addition to that, Jacob's response to the latter dream is, surely the Lord is in this place and I did not know it, right? Which is quite comparable to Nathanael's non-recognition of God until he saw Jesus at that point in time. You were here and I didn't even know you were here. I didn't know God was on earth. I didn't know that the Messiah was here. I was hungering for it. I was looking for it. I was reading through Genesis. I didn't know you were here. Same thing as what Jacob did. So the only acceptable response, again, as I reiterate the point several times so that you guys latch onto this, is the exact same thing that Jacob did and that Nathanael did, awe and worship. So when I say worship, what do I mean by that? How does that impact our lives? We call worship the time when the band comes up and we get ushered into the throne room of the Lord, right? That's the worship music. But when we worship God, we allow Him to transform our lives. Any time that you worship something or someone, and you can be misled, you can be deceived in those kinds of things, but any time that you're worshiping something, you're saying, this thing is greater than I am. I love this thing. This thing is bigger than me. And so when you worship God, you have to acknowledge, my pride comes down a few notches. God is greater. God knows more than me. He has a plan for my life. He lets me make some mistakes, but He uses that to guide me in the right way, right? That's what worship truly is. And so we must have awe and worship for God in the exact same way that Jacob and Nathanael had that. Going back to Jacob, remember, he exclaims that place is great, because God is there, and he calls it Bethel, which means house of God. What does Jacob mean that this is God's house? Well, he would have been familiar with pagan temples. He would have seen those different things. He would have thought, okay, so those gods, if they're real, they live in that temple. They live in that place. But wait a minute, I'm outside, and the one true God has spoken to me. This must be his house. Outdoors must be his house. He's not held in by four walls. This place must be Bethel. This must be his house. He's very conscious of God's house, calling it that. So Jacob has a spiritual growth spurt here. He seems to think that God dwells in this place. It's kind of like he says, almost in this place only, but it's interesting because the last part of what God says is, I will be with you as you go out. Now, Jacob, why would you want to leave Bethel, God's house, and go out from the presence of the Lord if that's where God stays, right? And so, yes, in a sense, this is God's house because he was there, but God's house is everywhere. God says he will go with you. So Jacob kind of doesn't quite get that portion of it. God promises to go with Jacob, just as he promises to go with us wherever we may go. How else could he keep his promise to Jacob, right? That's what God is all about. So this section finishes out with verses 20 through 22. I'll read them for you. Then Jacob made a vow, saying, if God will be with me and keep me in this way that I am going, and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on, so that I may come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God, and this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, God, I will surely give a tenth to you. Jacob decides to set up a memorial of the experience. His pillow rock, he sets it up, he pours oil on it, which shows consecration and that the place was holy. Okay? Now, the oil is a first mention here. Principle of first mention. I've talked to you about that before. Principle of first mention simply means that when the Bible says something for the first time and it's mentioned again in other places, we can understand that that first point has a lot of significance. It teaches us a lot about what's happening in that moment, and we can learn from that and apply it to other points. This is God giving us the principle of first mention for oil in the Bible. First time that oil is used. So what do we gain from this? When oil is used, it shows God has spoken and acted, and because He is holy, the people and or the place He chooses is holy also. Oil is a symbol of divine blessing, metaphorically as a bestowal of divine favor, according to Psalm 23:5 and 92:10. The appointment to a special function of God's purpose, oil. Appointment to a special function of God's purpose, Psalm 105:15, Isaiah 45:1, and the equipment for service by the Spirit of God. We see the Holy Spirit talked about as oil, people putting the oil on and the Holy Spirit coming on them in places like 1 Samuel 10:1 and 16:13 and many other places throughout the Bible. So Jacob's mistake was in trying to bargain over God's will and blessing. I think that that's important. He does the right thing in consecrating. He says oil, and he does all of that. This is a memorial. I want to recognize this as being a very unique and amazing time here with God. But what does Jacob do? Notice this. Notice the words that he says. If God will be with me and do all of these different things, then I will, right? So it's an if-then kind of thing for Jacob. If you do this stuff for me, then I'll go ahead and do this stuff for you, God. Right? Oftentimes we can be like that. If God will be with me and feeds me and clothes me and brings me home safely, then the Lord shall be my God. It's interesting that there's no doubt in Jacob's mind that the Lord is God, the one true God, just whether Jacob will call him his God. Do you remember earlier when he was talking to his father Isaac and he said, the Lord your God? You believe in that guy, whoever he is, if he's real. I don't know. Is he a lump of stone? Is he a piece of wood? Is he any different than an idol that I see these other pagan people worshiping? He's your God. That's fine. That's good for you. Now we start to see those hints of transformation in Jacob. He's still deceiver. He's still negotiating. He's still trying to work it out with God. He's still trying to say, I'm not just going to accept your blessing, by the way. You really got to come through for me on these things, God. If you do those different things, then I'll acknowledge you as God, right? I'm going to read that to you again. It's interesting that there is no doubt in Jacob's mind that the Lord is God. He recognizes him as God. The Lord is God, just whether Jacob will call him his God. Will Jacob recognize the one true God to be his God? Will he take God into his heart? Will he make God on the throne over his heart? Will he submit? Will he step down? Will he stop being the deceiver? Will he stop being the negotiator, always looking for the contract, always looking for the best win for him? If, God, you fulfill these things, then, yeah, if you're lucky, I'll do this. Yeah, Jacob, we'll see how well that works, you bargaining with God. In conclusion, no matter how bad Jacob was here, no matter what he did, how he deceived, lied, all of those different things, God just still reaches out. He meets Jacob. Very first night that he's out alone, he's finally walked away from the family. God is going to get a hold of him. Very, very first night that he's out there, God hits him right off the bat. He has this amazing dream. He sees all of these things which are true about the one true God. God speaks to him and says, look, this is the lineage that you come from. I want to fulfill these things through you. This is how I'm going to take care of you. This is how I'm going to be with you. These are the things that we're going to achieve together, Jacob. He works with him. As we'll see next time in the next sermon when we cover the parts 2 and 3 of Jacob's transformation, we're going to see that God cares enough to discipline Jacob. God cares enough to discipline us in our lives also, to help guide us through these different things. the real takeaway, I believe, from all of this, these are all good things. We understand the deception and all of that, but hopefully we're sort of on the cross side of that. We're away from those things. So the takeaway for me, and hopefully for you, is that recognition of Jesus claiming to be that ladder, Jesus claiming to be that staircase, that one way to heaven, right? Jesus came down, he descended from heaven, and he came down being both fully God and fully man, the Messiah, right? But he couldn't have walked in these ways. He couldn't have known these different things, and we'll get into this in the next sermon, but he couldn't have truly known these things unless he came down in that physical sense and became fully man and walked with us and said, yeah, I know what it's like to have that anguish and the difficulties and all of those different kinds of things. And so he came down on earth to take away all the bad stuff that we've done, what we call sin, all that bad stuff. And he died on the cross for us, completely innocent. He went to the cross and died for those sins for us. It's both the most complex thing and the simplest thing at the same time. All that we have to do is acknowledge that Jesus did those things and turn our hearts towards him. That's when we get to hang on to Jesus and go, awesome, I get to ascend that ladder, that staircase. I get to go into heaven through Jesus. Jesus is that staircase to heaven. That's awesome. So, so important for us. If some of this stuff doesn't make sense, if you have questions on any of this or comments or whatever, see me afterwards. If you're not comfortable with seeing me, then see somebody else who kind of looks like they've got it together, and like they might know something about the Bible. I would encourage you, see me or not, but grab a copy of a Bible. We've got bunches in the back. Take one home. Read through the Bible yourself.